Welcome everybody to the Brett Contreras Podcast. I'm your host, Brett Contreras.
So this is the first episode of the Brett Contreras Podcast. I've had other podcasts before, and they were always with other people. So this idea came about because from time to time, there are different articles and topics that emerge in strength and conditioning that I want to review or talk about. And sometimes when you have other people you collaborate with, it's just hard to, you know, make times. This way I can do it on my time, usually late at night when everyone else is asleep because I'm a night owl. But anyway, I'm going to review two different articles and then some of my own blog posts. So I hope you enjoy this. The first article is going to be Squat Mechanics, A Deep Analysis. And this is by Mark Ripito. So in my blog, I'll have links to all of these articles. So you can check them out. But this is a very good article, and I wanted to review it because I pretty much agree with Mark here. But there are some things I wanted to elaborate on. So it's funny because if some of you who most of you are probably aware of Mark Ripito, he wrote the book Starting Strength. It's a classic in strength and conditioning. I definitely recommend you buy it if you haven't read it already. But especially the I don't have the I think it's like the latest edition is like the third edition or something like that. But I stumbled across a bunch of different images from that product when I was working on my own product, the bonus product to my 2x4, which is the when I went over the biomechanics of squats and deadlifts, and I investigated the joint torques and things like that, and I found that Mark had some really good diagrams that he made. So anyway, I'll just dive right into it. The first thing about the article I wanted to talk about is he says that he has to deprogram the vertical back angle of almost everyone that comes to seminars. And I thought this was funny because I agree with this. When you train beginners, most people think that they have to be so upright in the squat. They think that a proper squat is as upright as humanly possible. And so they'll typically just kind of keep the torso upright and bend at the knees. So the knees push forward and it's like an impossible squat to pull off. But most of the people that attend Mark's seminars are probably very advanced and they're still staying super upright. So he talks about this and he thinks that it has to do with people, you know, watching Olympic weightlifters and probably bodybuilders too. Olympic weightlifters are trying to, you know, maximize the transfer to their competition lifts, which are the snatch and the clean and jerk, which require upright torsos. And then bodybuilders are trying to, you know, target the quadriceps, so they'll try and stay upright as well. But this article is about learning how to squat the heaviest amount of load possible. So Mark believes that you should have considerable torso lean. Now, one thing that is ironic and that I started paying attention to in my own training of clients is that every client I train eventually becomes too hip dominant to where their squat mechanics actually erode. And I started noticing this with all of my clients after, you know, 6 months of training with me, their hips will shoot up and they'll sort of turn the squat into like a good morning. And I never teach it that way, of course. I just wasn't quite as strict. It's like if they got the squat good, and I didn't watch for that so carefully. But in the last, you know, probably 8 months, I've really been keeping an eye on it, and I've written about it in a few articles, how you don't want the hips to shoot up faster than the, you know, the knees, and this way your back angle stays the same. And so so in order to prevent that, I've actually had most of my clients start doing high bar squats or front squats with their feet elevated onto a plate, and just to kind of get them in the habit of squatting upright again. And then I don't let them, I make them stick with that for a while until they can start staying upright and using their quads again so their hips don't shoot up so bad. But Mark doesn't mess around with the high bar squat or the front squat. He teaches the back squat, and he has a particular way of teaching it. And the first thing he says is that you probably have a picture in your head of this Olympic squatter, and you need to get rid of that picture in your head of the squat is supposed to be super upright. And the way he teaches a squat is to let the, basically at the bottom of the movement, your knees will migrate forward a little bit, but not too much. He said the knee migration will be about equal to the toes, the front of the feet, the front of the shoe. And so that's not a lot of forward knee travel. It's a little bit. It's not like you're completely sitting back to where your shins are vertical, but it's not a lot. If you're very upright, a lot of times the knees will shoot out well over the toes. And then he recommends a foot flare of approximately 30 to 35 degrees with the knees aligned over the feet. So the knees stay out, they don't cave in, but they don't go outwards past your feet. And so when you do a squat this way, the bar has to stay centered over the shoes or the midfoot. And so what ends up happening is when you limit forward knee migration, then you have to lean forward a lot. And your torso, your back angle is more forward lean than most people think is healthy, or, you know, would think of, would picture when they're thinking of the best way to squat. And he says, you don't need to worry about this. The back will be okay. And this is something that I agree with from both personal experience and with training other people with considerable forward lean. Lane Norton comes to mind. Lane Norton has a huge forward lean. In fact, probably too much for what Mark Ripito would recommend. And he kind of turns it into a squat warning because of his long femurs. He's got a unique, you know, anthropometry. But Lane never hurts himself on the squat. And the reason why is his back stays rigid. He doesn't round. He might round. I was talking to Lane about this. He might round, you know, every once in a while on like the last rep of a brutal set. But for the most part, you know, 98% of the time, Lane's torso remains rigid. And that's why he doesn't hurt himself. And that's what Mark Ripito is saying. If you have a flat back, then you will not hurt yourself in the squat. And if you think of good mornings, you know, most people, it's kind of ironic. They're okay with people doing good mornings as an assistance lift, but then they say you're going to hurt your back with a squat if you lean forward. And Mark says, flexing the spine is bad. You know, if you round your back, then it's bad and you can get hurt. And it's not so much that you can get hurt. It's just an energy leak. It's not an efficient, some of the power is lost, you know, is dissipated into the system, which I agree with. Now, I do have a couple of minor points of contention in this article that I would like to bring up. The first one is where Mark talks about a shear force, in that he says a moment is a shear force. And to me, a moment is turning force. It's rotational force about the joint. There's compressive and shear forces. Compressive is the vertical aspect of the force, and shear is the shearing force, the horizontal force against the structures. So the spine, it will have, you know, left to right forces on the spine. And so I'm not sure if Mark is correct on that, but I could be wrong about that too. But anyway, I do agree with him that he says shearing force is overrated. He talks about how, you know, people's spines don't just slide apart. And I agree with this. In fact, I wrote about, this is an old Teenation article I have called Contreras Files Volume 2. And since then I've actually pulled up a lot more articles, but I think I have around 20 articles in this little chart that I made. And I listed the compressive loading and the shear loading in a bunch of different activities. And I just explained to you that, you know, it's not as dangerous. You think like pushing open a door, pushing and pulling at waist height with 40% of body weight led to 1,100 to 1,200 newtons of shearing force. You know, lifting a 50-pound box from knee to waist height led to 1,200 to 1,600 newtons of shearing force. And so the most experts in this area will tell you that the maximum shear loads should be limited to 1,000 newtons. And this is what I have with, you know, using some of these safety recommendations. For example, in 1981, the NIOSH, they set limits for compressive forces at 3,400 newtons, with maximum permissible limits at 6,300 newtons. But there's a study on deadlifts. Let me see if I can find it. And it shows that It shows that, yeah, ColaWikis. This is a classic study by ColaWiki. And it showed that there were 17,192 newtons of compressive force in the deadlift. And that's so far exceeds, you know, the recommended limits by a factor of three. And, you know, it's like, what are we going to not have people deadlift? Are we not going to have people squat at all? Obviously, in strength and conditioning, we know that people can tolerate these loads, especially if they're using good form. And so I would be curious to see what the shearing forces of like pushing a heavy sled would be. It would be, you know, really high. For example, in a football lineman sled blocking maneuver, the shear loading was 3,304 newtons. That's over three times the recommended maximum limits. And now I think the football lineman blocking maneuver is pretty aggressive, but nevertheless, you know, pushing a sled is well tolerated. I think it would probably lead to maybe at least double, two times the limit. So we shouldn't really necessarily look at these maximum limits and just think, oh, we need to be afraid of doing these exercises, because half the stuff we do in strength and conditioning, you know, if you look at this chart that I made, half the stuff we do exceeds these limits. Any strongman, event is going to far exceed the compressive loading limits. Like I said, deadlifting and squatting is going to far exceed it with, you know, this compressive and the shear loading. So we don't need to worry so much. As we need to teach good form and make sure people progress gradually, and they will, I think they can tolerate these forces. So back to the article, a cue that Mark said he's been using that works well with clients is point your nipples at the floor. And I have not used that cue, but I made note of it, and maybe I'll use it in the future. But he also recommends an eye gaze of looking down at the floor in front of you, and this helps keep the cervical spine in neutral. And I've never really liked the looking up cue for squats. I like people to look straight ahead or downwards, but I think that's important to mention. Now, here's the most important part of the article, in my opinion, and something that I think some people didn't understand so much, and they need to understand. So the way that Ripito recommends to squat is that around halfway down in your squat, your back position will reach the correct angle around halfway down. And then you keep that back angle all the way down and all the way up until you reach that position again, until you get halfway up again. So that's his hip drive model. The hips will shoot straight up. And so halfway down, your knees will be around the front of your knees. If you dropped a line straight vertically down from the knees, they'd be around the front of your shoes. And then as you keep descending, it will be kind of like the hips will have to be back. And then the hips descend. You keep the same back angle, and then the same back angle as you rise up out of the squat until you've reached around halfway up, and then the back angle becomes more vertical. And so that's his hips drive model, and I think it's a good model to follow. Now, another thing I disagree with, he mentions the hip extension moment arms in a front squat versus a back squat, and he says that the moment arms for the hamstrings in the front squat is less than what you get in a back squat, and I don't agree with that. I think that he should double check that. I think with the front squat, the bar is out in front of the body more. So the way you estimate these moment arms is you draw a line from the bar down through the middle of the feet, and then you calculate the distance from that line to the joint centers at the hips and knees, and that'll get you the hip extension and the knee extension torque. That'll get you the moment arms, and then you multiply that times the load in kilograms, and you'll get the torque. But he has a good illustration in the T-Nation article on that that kind of illustrates that. But in the front squat, yes, you're more upright, but the bar is out in front of the body, so I think that it washes out. It equalizes with the back squat. In the back squat, you've got more of a lean, but in the front squat, the bar is positioned more in front of the body, so I think the hip extension moment arms are pretty similar between the back squat and the front squat, and I think that's why you get similar glute and hamstring EMG activity But that doesn't mean just the EMG activity doesn't mean you're getting the same exact force production, because if one muscle is at a longer length, then you're going to get more passive elastic force contribution. And in the back squat, I think the, especially done the way Ripito recommends, the hamstrings will be a little more taut and, you know, a little more stretched compared to a vertical torso front squat. And so for this reason, they're going to provide a little bit more passive elastic force contribution. Now, it was interesting that he showed an example of Dan Green, the powerlifter, a very strong powerlifter. And in the comments section of the article, Ripito mentioned that he thinks that the Dan Green squat is how you do it. It's done right. And interestingly, I went to Dan Green's seminar at my buddy's gym several months back at Revolution Training Systems in Tempe. And it was a very good seminar. Dan Green is very, very humble. He explains things very well. And I really enjoyed the seminar and learning how Dan thinks, you should squat and deadlift and bench press. And interestingly, Dan Green, you know, he kind of does it like what Mark Ripito recommends here. Now, Dan Green does think the quads are important. And I think that Mark Ripito thinks the quads are still important, but Mark Ripito thinks you need a hip dominant squat, you know, with hip drive, but you're still using the quads. But the way Dan Green described how he squats, he says that after it didn't look like he did this in the video so much, but I think in training he does this more. After he, you know, unracks the barbell, he kind of leans forward a little bit and gets his trunk angle set a little bit, because he said at the bottom of the squat, you end up at that lean. So why not, instead of having this kind of unsynchronous, you know, torso angle throughout the movement, why not just kind of set it there from the get-go? Whereas Mark says your torso angle should be there halfway down. Dan kind of tries to kind of set up with kind of a lean and then just drop down. But it's just two different people kind of arriving at a similar conclusion. And then in the comments section of the article, Ripito acknowledges that people's form will vary due to anthropometry. Not everyone's going to look the exact same. But if you, what I like about what Mark does is he generalizes here. He makes, you know, generalizations that apply to the masses. And that's really hard to do because everyone's so different. But I do agree with his approach. And he also mentions that this just applies to the low bar squat, and he doesn't do high bar, and so he doesn't understand why someone would do high bar. Now, I happen to like high bar squats, especially for women. A lot of my female clients have a lot of trouble with low bar. I've been successful with getting a lot of my girls to squat with low bar, and the ones who have, they set immediate PRs. You know, if they've been high bar squatting and you teach them low bar. In fact, just this last week, I had three different girls set PRs with low bar squatting because they come to my gym wanting to train and they've only done high bar, and I teach them low bar. And even though it's unfamiliar and doesn't feel as coordinated, I teach them to lean a little bit more and they set PRs. And most people are stronger with low bar. I would venture to guess that 9 out of 10 lifters are stronger with low bar. However, some women don't do very well with low bar because it just does not feel stable, and they're scared to death that the bar is going to, you know, fall off their back, especially with women that don't have a lot of muscle mass. So I wonder what Mark does in this instance, I wonder if he has success with every single person doing low bar, or if there's certain women or certain people who struggle with that. But anyway, all in all, I agree with his approach. I like the way he teaches the squat. I read Starting Strength, the first edition, and I don't know if he's changed it much in the past or if it's, you know, evolved at all, but I remember having some minor points of contention. But all in all, I think Mark has the best kind of this. I think it's the best approach that I've seen to date with generalizing an approach to the squat that's going to maximize the strength of most lifters. Now, Olympic lifters, this was actually, Mark was arguing with a guy that went by the name Mike the Bear in the comments section. They were arguing about, you know, whether Olympic lifters should use high bar or not. I think Mark thinks that Olympic lifters should use the low bar squat and then the front squat. Front squat because it's, you know, more upright and it's more specific to the clean and jerk and then the snatch, and then the low bar to maximize hip strength. And he says that, you know, he cites different positions in Olympic lifting where you are leaning forward. And so he thinks that the actually using the low bar would transfer better to Olympic lifting because you're also front squatting. And that's a very interesting discussion. However, most Olympic lifters don't do it that way. They do high bar and they do front squats. And so I'm curious if that would affect the recovery, because some people get beat up a little more with low bar squats due to the forward lean. It might tax the CNS a little bit more or something like that, or just require, you might be able to get away with high bar squatting more frequently than low bar squatting, especially due to the fact that you're going to likely be using lighter loads. But nevertheless, it's a very interesting discussion, and I really liked the article. Okay, the next article I wanted to discuss is also a T-Nation article, and this one was titled, Steroids, What Pro Bodybuilders Are Really Using. And this one, I've written about this before, and the reason why I want to talk about this is because, you know, a lot of newbies and people just getting into the game, they'll see these pictures of bodybuilders, and they'll think, you know, they aren't aware, they aren't knowledgeable about what these bodybuilders are doing. And I added up in weeks 1 through 10 the milligrams of steroids that an advanced bodybuilder would be using, and it came to 3,700 milligrams. And based on people I've talked to, this seems accurate. And so just for reference, the human male makes around 7 to 10 milligrams a day of testosterone with the Leydig cells in the testicles. And so, just give you a frame of reference, the male in a week is making 50 to 100 milligrams of testosterone, and the bodybuilder is taking almost 4,000 milligrams. So you can see why they get so muscular. And, you know, and I think this is important to talk about, because people have unrealistic expectations of how jacked they're going to get when they start lifting weights. And then it wasn't just the different steroids. There was also growth hormone and insulin and things like that. I added up all the different, during the 16-week recommended period, they were using 16 different drugs, and including anti-estrogens, including, you know, insulin and clenbuterol and growth hormone and all these different things, and you know, plenty of different anabolic steroids. And so just, I'm not, you know, I don't really judge people. I have a lot of friends that use, but I will tell you that, you know, as someone who has not used, who trains natural, there are some natural lifters that get stronger every single year. For example, I mentioned Lane Norton earlier. Lane keeps getting stronger year in and year out. You know, I have a lot of respect for him for that. Some people's natural lifters tend to kind of reach a plateau and they cannot get any stronger, it seems. It's an interesting topic to speculate about, but I think it has to do with genetics. And I wrote an article a while back on T-Nation years ago called The Truth About Bodybuilding Genetics. And if you read, I think some of the clues are in that article, where it looked at good responders and non-responders to resistance training, and their physiology is totally different. The IGF-1 or MGF-1 mechanogrowth factor, which is a splice variant of IGF-1, inside the muscles when you lift weights, the MGF response was completely different with good responders versus non-responders. The satellite cell pool efficiency was totally different. And so this might explain why some lifters keep getting stronger over the years and other lifters do not. But nevertheless, you should not expect to look like a pro bodybuilder if you're a natural lifter. You need to have realistic expectations and realize that, you know, you're dealing with a fraction of the chemicals that they have, of the anabolic, you know, the androgens that they're taking. So just keep that in mind. Okay, now I'd like to discuss a few blog posts that I've written. The first one is the 2-1 method for fixing glute imbalances. Now, I wrote this article on January 10th, and I liked this article because I realized I've got these female clients that, it's like I'm giving them bilateral training. I'm giving them squats. I'm giving them deadlifts. I'm watching their form. And some of them are starting to shift towards one way. And I'm paying attention to it. Now, I train twice a week. I train a group of 6 girls. So I'm training 6 girls at a time. It's 6 women, I should say. I'm not trying to be disrespectful. They're 6 women at a time. And it's hard to train 6 at a time. But I tend to watch the squats and deadlifts carefully. But it happens usually when over the holidays. One of my clients was very sporadic, and another hadn't trained in a while and came back to me, and I noticed they were shifting to the right, which means their right leg or glute or hip is stronger and their left is weaker. And you know, it's funny because I'm known as the glute guy, and you would think that I have, you know, my training methods are efficient enough to where no one would develop an imbalance, and they still did. So this is a very common, I get this all the time. And with one of my clients, when she did reverse hypers, she was doing reverse hypers, and I was watching her form, and I could see one glute was markedly bigger than the other at the top when she was contracted. You could see one group glute was larger. And so there are all sorts of reasons that I had a link in this article, how to fix glute imbalances. There are a lot of reasons why this could be, why this could come about. It can be for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it's a, you know, mobility discrepancy. Sometimes it's due to a prior injury. But at the end of the day, you got to come up with a solution. And one of the solutions I came up with was the 2-1 technique, where just at the very end of the workout, I have them do two different exercises that are single leg exercises. And I tend to stick with high step ups and single leg hip thrusts, but you could do single leg RDLs, you know, reverse lunges, Bulgarian split squats, skater squats, single leg back extensions. There are a lot of different, you know, good exercises that you could use with this. But what you do is you start with the weaker leg first. So you'll do the left leg, and then you'll do a set with the left leg, then a set with the right leg, and then another set with the left leg. And this way the left leg gets double the volume. And I do this at the end of the workout, and just as some added volume training for that weaker leg. Now you could say, why not just do two sets for the left leg? Why even do one for the right leg? And that would be a good question. I just have a hard time doing something just for the left side and not for the right side at all. But it might be another approach that you could use. And then the other thing I do in concordance with this protocol is that I on their bilateral lifts, a lot of times, you know, you can have, say, you know, say they, you have a load that they can lift for 8 reps while on the squat or something like that. And during the squat is when these glute imbalances rear their ugly heads the most. But sometimes it happens with even deadlifts and other lifts. But with squats, I might say they have an 8 rep max load and they could do it 8 reps. They can usually do the first 5 pretty symmetrically. And then they start rep 6, you'll see them shift. Rep 7, shift more. And rep 8 is like horrible, horrendous. And so what I do is I'll have them stop at like rep 5. And then while I'm coaching them the whole time, I'm like, okay, be symmetrical. And they watch themselves in the mirror because I have a mirror in front of me. And that's debated whether you should use mirrors or not. But one value with you having the mirror is they can see if they're shifting to one side. And so I've noticed that just in doing this for a month, one of my clients is looking way better, and I had her like flex her glute muscles as hard as she could, and I was kind of palpating to see if there's any discrepancy between the two, and they seem to be the same size now. She's not using as much compensation. She's not shifting as much, and her form has gotten better. It's not completely solved, but it is definitely a lot better. And that's just in 1 month of doing the extra volume for the weaker side. It's interesting, on my Facebook page, the image that I used pissed off a lot of some women. And I'm going to keep posting pictures like this. I've been doing it for 5 years. There are pictures like this in the muscle magazines, in the female muscle magazines. I have pictures of men that I use as well. And I don't mean to sound like a jerk, but to my female readers who have a problem with my pictures, I write about glutes. And, you know, I'm going to keep putting pictures of glutes. And sometimes I like to put a picture of what the article is about. And I get accused that this is a strategy that I use to get more clicks and more shares and things like that. But I actually think it gets me less shares, because if I have my thumbnail picture as a picture of someone's butt, people are going to be less inclined to share it because they don't want to offend their family members and their friends and things like that. So I don't think this leads to more shares. I'm not doing it to get popularity. There reaches a point in time where it actually works against you. But I do it because I write about glutes, and I don't get offended over pictures of glutes. And some of the people online said, you know, I open this up while I'm at work and some of my coworkers see it and it makes me look like a creep. And I can sympathize with that, but then just don't read my blog during the day when you're at work. Read it at nighttime or something like that. And some of these people, like, I don't like certain people's blogs. There's some people who are very vulgar in the industry, and I don't care too much for their material. I just don't read it. But I don't go onto their Facebook page and tell them, you know, oh my God, I'm so offended. You should quit, you know, just quit reading my blog and walk away. You don't need to voice your opinion. I know people's opinion. But I did a poll like a year and a half ago, and I found out that it's the minority that's offended by this. Like 8% of people are offended by it, but 92% are motivated and love seeing the pictures. But it's the 8% that are offended that are the most vocal. And so I don't put as many, you know, like scandalous pictures in my blogs, but sometimes I think it fits. So my apologies if I offend you, but you don't have to read my blog, you know? I understand if you don't like, if that makes you feel uncomfortable looking at pictures of glutes, I understand. Just, you don't have to read it. I won't get offended. I just don't understand when people write me and say, you lose all your credibility when there's, you know, I'm going to great lengths to investigate these, you know, methods and advance the glute training. And so I don't understand why someone would say you lose all credibility. Maybe you could say, you know, I could see how I offend them. But again, just go away, walk away, and don't read my blog, or read it when you're at home so the coworkers don't see it. But I'm tired of getting chewed out about it. Okay, the next article I want to talk about is A Day in the Life of the Glute Guy, All That Glitters Is Not Gold. And this one I wrote on January 12th. And this one I wrote because on Facebook lately, I'm getting a lot of people that they'll talk about my, you know, they'll be like, man, you have the life, or, oh, your life is so tough. You train girls with amazing butts all day long. But I was thinking about it, and I was thinking about, like, the DJ at the strip club, for example. Does that guy have the greatest life in the world? Because he gets to stare at, you know, naked women all day long. But it's not, it doesn't, I don't know. I kind of think of it like steak. If I love steak and I love filet mignons, and you came and waved a filet mignon in front of me every day and made me smell it, but I couldn't eat it, it would actually be annoying because I don't get to eat it. Well, the same thing with training these beautiful women. I'm not, you know, tasting the goods. I have a fiance and, you know, I don't, it's just a professional setting. I don't, it's not like I'm, you know, I think some people think that I'm sleeping with all these women or something like that. And it's quite the opposite. So, and I don't even, you know, it's just business to me. I palpate glutes and I make sure glutes are working and contracting. It doesn't, you know, I don't get like, you know, turned on by it or anything. It's just business. And so I wrote this article to tell people, it's not like I'm just surrounded by, you know, naked women having these crazy sexual escapades every day. It's quite the opposite. I'm usually in my house researching and either reading through research or, you know, working on my PhD, conducting experiments and things like that. And that's what my day is like. It's not nearly as exciting as people think. A lot of times I get bored on the weekends because my fiance has been out of town. I want to do something social, but all my friends are asleep or they're married, they have kids. I don't really have many friends that go out anymore, so sometimes I'll just go grab a beer by myself and then come home. It's really boring life. So I ended that blog with what people think I do, what I think I do, and what I really do. And I feel bad when people have this wrong perception of my life. Okay, the next article, Don't Be a Slave to the Scale. Now this one, I wrote this because I had a few different clients that were complaining to me. It's like I said, man, you're kicking butt. Your strength is amazing. And, you know, your physique is looking great. And then they'd say, I know, but, you know, I weigh 115 and I want to be 110, or I weigh 136 and, you know, my ideal weight is 130. And they're it's like on the one hand, they're happy about, you know, their strength and their, you know, the way that their body is shaping up. But they cannot be satisfied until they reach this, you know, preconceived, pre-thought up weight that they want to weigh, and the number on the scale. And if it doesn't fit that, then they're just, you know, very disappointed. And so, so I decided to do some researching. And what I always tell these women is, look, if you want to weigh 130, you can weigh 130. Like, say the one of my clients that's 136. If you want to weigh 130, you can weigh 130. Just quit eating so much. You know, drop your calories down. She doesn't want to count calories. She doesn't want to, you know, she doesn't want to weigh her food and things like that. So she just relies on, you know, her hunger. And I studied the hunger, of the hormonal, you know, hunger hormone effects of exercise. And it's just, it's kind of a mess of research. It's not very clear. I think some people do get hungrier. And so you have to watch it. You can't just rely on, you know, hunger to guide you, because you'll start gaining weight. But if you are diligent and you exert willpower, then you will either stay the same weight or you will lose weight. And, but that doesn't explain all of it. Some of the weight that people gain is through just retaining more water, but it's not retaining water like the, like if you were on your, like if a woman was on her period, that's extracellular water gain. That's bloat. That makes you look worse. But when it's intracellular water gain, you look better. And so I found a couple of different studies, that one looking at short term and one looking at long term. So right after a workout, your muscles will have around 7 to 8% more water content in them, through cell swelling and things like that, and increased, you know, glycogen compensation and muscle damage and things like that cause the muscle to swell and store more water. But then chronically, after several months of training, you also have around 8% more water that you're holding. And so this amounts to several pounds of, you know, of fluid retention. And so that can explain some of the weight gain that people have. It's water in their muscles. And so this doesn't make you look worse. This makes you look better. It makes your muscles look full. In fact, a lot of the strategies that bodybuilders employ are aimed at that peak week. It's aimed at, you know, maximizing the water inside of the muscle and minimizing the water outside, you know, the extracellular water. And they do this by kind of manipulating sodium and carbs and water, and which that's debated whether you need to manipulate the sodium. But I think it can help a little bit, but it's more the water and the carbs. But anyway, it can make a big difference in one's physique, you know, but they don't try to minimize, you know, it's not like they try to just dehydrate their bodies as much, because then their muscles look flat. So you want that extracellular muscle. It makes your body look better. And interestingly, athletes who lift weights have, they're actually, their lean body mass has lower density than other athletes because of this water, because water is less dense than muscle mass. And so they actually have lower density in their lean body mass component than other athletes. But this is because they do store more water. Now, how is this so? This happens because your muscles, after like 5 months, one study showed after 5 months of heavy resistance training, glycogen increased by 66%. And with every gram of glycogen that's stored in the muscles, along with it comes around 2 to 3 grams of water. So the glycogen gets pulled into the muscle, and then 2 to 3 grams of water comes along with it. So now you're retaining way more water than normal inside the muscles. Now, I found an interesting study that looked at just 3 days on a very low carb diet, glycogen stores decreased by a third of their initial values. So it decreased by, you know, a factor of 3, but then they kind of replenished with a high carb diet, and they kind of gorged with carbohydrates, and all of a sudden their glycogen levels shot up, and they actually rose by a factor of 6. So they decreased by a factor of 3 and then rose by a factor of 6, meaning they doubled their initial values. So that's what like marathon runners will do. They'll like purposely do employ a strategy like that, so they have glycogen supercompensation, so they have more energy during their race. But anyway, these fluctuating glycogen levels, they create the illusion of rapid fat loss and regain, but it's mostly water. And so, you know, what people will do is they'll go on like a low carb diet and lose, you know, 10 pounds in 10 days or 4 days or something like that. And they think it's all fat, and really most of it's water. And then they'll gorge themselves with like maybe a night of junk food, and they have a ton of carbs, and then they'll gain all that weight back. And then they think it's all fat, when it's really just the water, you know, manipulating water content in the body plays a large role in that. So, understanding this can help manage people's expectations. So this is why I say, don't just rely on the scale weight. Look at scale weight, look at body fat levels, look at your measurements, you know, arm, chest, waist, hips, thighs, look at how your clothes fit, use progress pictures. Every month you should be taking a progress picture under the same lighting, with the same outfit on, in the same position, with the same posture. And this way you can see, using the same camera, and this way you can really see, are you, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, I haven't really seen any results for the last 6 months. And then they look at their progress pictures and they're blown away. They're like, wow, I can't believe how much I've changed. So make sure you're taking regular progress pictures. Compliments from others. You know, you see yourself in the mirror every day, but other people might go a few weeks without seeing you and they'll be like, wow, this person's looking great. How fit and how conditioned you feel. You know, your body doesn't lie to you. You know when you're fit and conditioned. And then other measures of health, such as blood pressure, cholesterol, triglycerides, blood sugar, insulin sensitivity, inflammation, things like that. And what's interesting is one of the clients that I had who was really frustrated at her weight, she showed up and she put on her work pants, and all of a sudden there was like an inch and a half gap in her pants. And it's like, she gained 5 pounds, but she lost an inch and a half around her waist. This is why everyone's telling her she looks totally differently. So that made her very happy. And she's kind of starting to understand, you know, I shouldn't just go by scale weight. I should pay attention to the entire picture. And that helped her be happier. Okay. And then the last article I wanted to talk about is, why should I use good form if I'm stronger with bad form? And this article I just wrote a couple days ago, January 18th, and it's a video that I filmed. But what I liked about this is I said, I came up with five primary ways that you can perform an exercise, usually a compound exercise. You can do it in a manner that best targets a particular muscle. You can do it in a manner that allows for the greatest load to be lifted at the moment, and that's acutely. Like if I said to you, pull the heaviest weight you can pull right now in the deadlift, maybe your back would round, maybe not. If I said squat the most weight you can right now, maybe your knees would cave in, maybe they wouldn't. But that's acutely. But then in the third way is in a manner that allows for the greatest load to be lifted in the long run. Now that's longitudinally, meaning what way should you train, you know, week in and week out in order to lift the heaviest weights in the long run? And this is where like Mark Ripito's article comes into play, where that's, you know, his way of squatting is a good way to squat if you're trying to be strongest in the long run in the squat. And then number four is in a manner that best distributes the stress amongst the various joints and is generally the safest. And then number five is in a manner that will best transfer to particular sport. So sometimes different, like say track and field athletes will put their own spin on an exercise because they think it transfers better. And there's not a lot of research in that. But anyway, it's a good video you can watch, which helps shed some light on, you know, so, because I think that's something that confuses people. It's like they hear what ideal form is, they hear what good form is, but, you know, they might be like a lot of my female clients, when they deadlift, I try to get their hips lower, but they can deadlift, you know, more weight with their hips high than with their hips low. They can almost stiff leg deadlift more weight than they can deadlift with their hips lower. And sometimes it doesn't always, you know, some people are like that. You go to powerlifting meets and sometimes you see people practically stiff leg the weight up. And these are powerlifters who train, you know, they're training, they're doing the squat. You'd think they would be strong in the legs, but it's just due to anthropometry in their bodies. And so watch the video. I think you'll like it. Anyway, this concludes the first episode. I hope you enjoy the material and I hope you enjoyed listening to it. Thank you.